So I heard from the ambassador that you became something of a media star there. You were on the radio and TV regularly, and people really trusted you. The president trusted you. The embassy staff trusted you. The healthcare workers trusted you, and it made a really big difference.
Yeah, I tried to pass the message. Ebola is scary for everybody, but there is more scare than real danger for most of the people, especially the expat there, where the risk is very low. But I pay attention to make presentation to the people from the embassy, the U.S. embassy, but also the British embassy, the French embassy, but also have a special session in French with the driver, the cleaner, the people in the embassy that transfer more message. I always think the driver in the international response is the most important, because people are afraid to talk to you, but they go talk to the driver and ask the question. So,
yeah, good. The Guinea is in much better situation today than Liberia or Sierra Leone. What led to the progress? What were the steps in getting into a better control situation?
I think maybe that Guinea is in maybe better shape, even in the area where the outbreak started, that the area where we have the outbreak now in Sierra Leone and in Liberia. The whole difficult area, this triangle, is very difficult. The roads are very bad. The situation is not good for the health system. The people are quite isolated. Most of them speak a local language, but they stay in their area. They may be less considered than the other people in the country. I don't know. But they have, because of the bad road, very few exchange. Even if they travel a lot, Guineans are traveling all over the world. And we see in this outbreak that was a big problem. People are sick, or before they've been sick, they move to another place, see a cousin, a friend, a family, and then they become sick in a new town. And even when they die, the body keep traveling to go back in the area. So I think we start before maybe Sierra Leone and Guinea Sierra Leone and Liberia let the things going on without having really data. The advantage maybe in Guinea was that the capital was affected quite early in the outbreak, so that raised the concern of everybody.
Mm-hmm. And then, so there was more attention to it earlier on.
Yeah, maybe that was the fact. And the government of Guinea realized that there was a risk. And the risk is for the people, but it's also a huge economical impact on the country.
And the other health problems. I've been hearing, since the health system isn't working or trusted, then malaria, pneumonia, diarrhea, all the deadly diseases are not being treated well.
And even some vaccination campaign were stopped because people were concerned of going in this area or didn't want to go and put another burden on the population.
And, of course, to begin with, these three countries had very weak health systems and very little in terms of primary care or preventive medicine. I don't even know if they'd introduced the newer vaccines, pentavalent, rotavirus, and pneumococcal.
I don't think so. And they just introduced the new, the more combined meningitis virus with all the serotype. Was just introduced this time for the
Menafrovac?
Yeah, the one with the
W135
bacteria.
So they're in the meningitis belt.
Yeah, they are in meningitis belt. And at the same time, when the Ebola outbreak started, they had an outbreak of measles, an outbreak of meningitis. The only thing they haven't seen yet is an outbreak of cholera that they usually have this time. And it's maybe because they use a lot of bleach. I don't know if that's the case. A lot of bleach for Ebola. Maybe that helped to push back the.
So we've really been following the playbook of Ebola response in terms of detection, contact elicitation, infection control, burial practice improvement, and contact management. That's the playbook. Mm-hmm. And. How did you help them improve each of those areas, and what were the tipping points there?
I think we try to get all the aspects. The problem is you have to be everywhere at the same time, and it's quite difficult. But burial practice, that is a big, big problem. We try to talk to the imam, all the imam from the country, to try to do that. I introduce, I don't know if it's used widely, but I'm going to push back on my next tour there, to try, if they have to wash the body, to wash it with bleach. It was shown in the early 90s that has some impact during cholera outbreak. So I don't think that affects. So we discussed with them to be sure that it was okay, religiously okay, to add bleach to the water.
The ambassador was telling me this remarkable story that there was, I guess, a cell phone company that's run by an Israeli company that gave free text messaging to the imams to send messages out on Friday with key messages like, if it's fasting time, you don't have to fast if you're using protective gear because you can't manage, and how to wash the body with bleach if you have to do the washing.
That was a big problem for MSF during the Ramadan, because when you wear all this protective gear, you need to drink. There is no way, and technically you cannot drink during the Ramadan. So we went to the imam to discuss if there was a way to go around that, and they explained that there was a way. In one of the sermon of the on the Friday during the Ramadan, they explained that there was no problem of doing that. There is some disposition in the Quran that say if you don't follow the Ramadan, you can defer to a later time. So we try to play with, to discuss with all the religious leader to be sure that we can add some messages that could be helpful. And it's not the recipe to save everything, but small detail after small detail, you can start to limit the transmission.
The it seems like the treatment services were run mostly or entirely by MSF there.
Mm-hmm. All by MSF with the organization that they have, and I think nobody can really compete with the organization. The problem they have is because it's very hard and very demanding, they are more or less the only one in the field, and they, with this outbreak in different country, different place in each country, they reach the limit. So they need to find, and they know that, to find some other people to help to do that. But it's huge. People think it's easy to treat an Ebola patient. It's not treating them. It's just the infrastructure around. You need 100 liter of water per day per patient to use all the disinfection that you're going to use, all the spraying around. It's huge. And when you have hospital where you have no running water, then you have to have the logistic to bring the truck to make that work.
How about contact elicitation and tracing and monitoring? That remains suboptimal.
Yes, because people are afraid of the stigmatization. And in some area, they don't want to be on the contact list because they think that is that put on the death roll, and because the name is on that. So it's very difficult. The problem we have also is communication with the people. When people do contact listing, some think, oh, you just go and see if the people is okay, yes or no, he has fever, yes or no. But it has to be used to pass message, to answer question to the people. And it's the same thing with the burial. The big problem with the burial is that the people that do the burial are usually not the top of the class. Mm-hmm. They scare themselves. They're afraid. They're not very nice with the people, with the family.
You mean the people who are trying to improve burial services? This is why we're using this digital green device to try. I don't know if it'll work. Do you have a sense?
I don't know if that's going to work. It has to be tried anyway.
Did the First Lady's taping go okay yesterday?
Yeah, the First Lady was good, so we trying to do that. Yeah. But I think it's...
First Lady of Guinea.
Of Guinea, that visit CDC yesterday. I've been involved in burial in other outbreak, and people don't like it when you impose on them some rule, but if you explain them, and I always think if you do that as if you're doing it someone from your family, it goes better. Now, if you really scare and you dress from the office to the house to the burial site, all dressed in white cosmonaut and scare everybody, that doesn't work. People don't like it, and they're right. They will not like it in the U.S. too.
It's very similar to the work that I did with tuberculosis, where you go to the patient and you have to make the patient the focus of the program, the VIP of the program, and make sure that they get the services they need, and then you get cooperation.
Yeah, it takes a lot of time, and every detail is important. That's the problem. If you don't pay attention to the detail, the thing can crash very easily.
How do you deal with safety of the staff? Staff dealing with burials or contactless visitation and healthcare, we found, you know, that there's risks for the health workers that aren't so much on the containment wards. It's outside of the containment wards from coworkers who might become ill or undiagnosed patients. Mm-hmm. Or
I think you have to adapt to the risk. We always found, and we used that in previous outbreak on thousands and thousands of contact tracing team, that if you just, when you do the contact tracing, you talk to the people, you ask them if they go, you stay at 1 or 2 meters away, there is no risk. If you show up with PPE, everybody going to be scared. And I think we have to, if we pass the message saying that Ebola is transmitted by direct contact, we have to behave the same way. We cannot say that to the people and then showing up with full PPE when you go in the village, because then you're going to scare everybody. So I think for the contact tracing, it's you don't really have to wear anything. You have to know what you're doing and pay attention. If you see a sick person, you don't touch it. You call whoever team is supposed to come and take care of that. Now, for burial, you really have to take a lot of precaution. But you usually, one thing that make it easier is the patient is not moving. So you know what you're doing, you know what's going to happen. If you take care of patient, it could be difficult.
So for a meter away is still 3 feet. People in airports taking temperatures maybe less than 3 feet away and not using personal protective equipment or PPE.
Yeah, but we know that people are infectious during the course of the disease. They're not infectious during incubation. And even the first few days of the disease, we want to repeat the diagnostic. If it's negative on day one of the disease, we consider that the patient is still suspect and we wait until day three to confirm. And that means at that time, it's sometimes difficult to find the virus. So I think the risk is very low at that time. It still exists. It's biology. You cannot say no risk at all. But I think the risk is very low.
For the healthcare facilities that aren't Ebola facilities in West Africa, they're getting patients coming in all the time with malaria and other conditions. Mm-hmm. What can we do there?
I think all of these countries don't have hospital hygienist, or if they have one, it has no power. So even in Guinea, we distribute, WHO distribute a lot of this hand washing station, but people are not using them, and the boss is not using them. So why the lower people will use it? And it's a problem of, I think, people should be trained and formed, but also I think they should be sanctioned sometime, because I always think that the chief need to show example. Mm-hmm. And there is no tradition of washing hand, and they all say, oh yes, when I will have an Ebola patient, I will wash my hand, but it's too late. You already saw one and you miss it. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to start to put in to develop in this country a concept of hospital infection, not only to protect the people working there, but also the other patient. Mm.
How much transmission is there from fomites, inanimate objects, in Ebola?
It's very limited. We know that we can find virus, and very often it's only by PCR, find virus in the different fomite, but we never saw any transmission. And study that we done in Kikwit, where we had a confirmed case of Ebola in the family, in the house, and you have all the people living around. In Kikwit, they had a tradition where the kids are not allowed to touch sick patients. They live in the same house, but they don't touch sick patients, whatever the disease is. We never saw transmission in kids. Even if they live in the same room, touch more or less the same thing in the house, there is no transmission. Again, it's not 100% because it's biology, but I think the risk is quite limited. Now, milk, every time we had a nursing mother infected, she transmit to the baby. Mm-hmm. That's always the case. But other fomite, sweat, it's always the question, sweat, droplet, there is a risk, and you have to adapt your PPE in consideration of the risk and make a risk assessment all the time. But I think the risk is, if you're not in direct contact, and we saw in Kikwit sleeping on the same bed that a patient with Ebola during the disease when he had vomit, diarrhea, and that was a very risky behavior. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think was the main driver of transmission?
Main driver is people cleaning secretion and excretion of people, cleaning vomit, cleaning diarrhea without any PPE, nothing, not even putting the hand in the plastic bag, and that direct contact, and then washing, cleaning the saliva of a patient or cleaning the face of a patient that is already sick, and obviously all the ritual around dead people when you wash the body without any precaution, and then that water is used for rubbing hand of the people that have done it, and we know that most of the patients die with diarrhea and vomiting, so it's a very risky behavior.
Yeah. How about bushmeat? Do you have a sense of what bushmeat is doing here and whether there are ways, practical ways, to reduce bushmeat consumption or improve handling of bushmeat?
I think stopping bushmeat consumption is a dream. I like animals, but they have no other meat. So if you want them to have access to protein, animal protein, you have to have bushmeat. We never saw that there is a risk with bushmeat beside diarrhea or other things, with bushmeat that is already processed, either smoke or cook. The risk is for people hunting the animals, having access to live animal or dying animal, blood, feces at that time. And we know in the Guinea Forestière, they eat a lot of bats, for example. But in most of the outbreak, including this one, we saw that the jump from bats to monkey or to human is very rare, happened at the beginning of the outbreak, and then after that is human to human transmission. And in country like Republic of Congo, where they had outbreak every year from 1999 to 2005, they still have infected bat around, but there is no case of Ebola since 2005. So the jump from the animal reservoir to the human is very rare. We don't know why. We start to understand a little bit with Marburg because we work experimental infection with animals, with bats. But other than that, we don't know exactly how that happened. But then after that is human to human.
Any theories as to how the virus got into this part of the world?
I think when you look at the distribution, the range of the bats that are suspected to be the carrier of Ebola, West Africa is included in that range. There is no migration as we think of bird migration from one country north, south, or east, west, or whatever. Most of the time it's north, south for the bats, but there is movement of population, and it's a big population, like what we call a meta population of bats in all Central Africa and West Africa. There was some paper published in 1993 by the Russian scientists in Guinea that show antibody against Ebola in some patient in 1983. at that time, everybody said, that's not very good result, never been confirmed and everything. But I think the virus was already there.
So should we do serological studies to understand more about the distribution of Ebola? Is it possible?
Has been done before. There is some researcher in Gabon that say that there is a lot of inapparent infections, which other people don't really believe. It's difficult when population is sick of malaria every month to think that they had no symptom. Maybe the symptom they had, they put the blame on the malaria, and it was a mild form of Ebola. But I'm sure there was plenty of other outbreak that happened that never been detected.
Mm-hmm. Now, Guinea has made really good progress. They're not out of the woods, and they're still getting cases and local transmission when their cases imported. Mm-hmm. But really, they're in much better shape than they were before. What's it going to take for Liberia and Sierra Leone to get into that kind of shape?
I think Guinea has a 2-3 months head start compared to the other countries. So they start in advance. And again, the capital was touched very early in the outbreak, so that make everybody recognize it. I think we'll have to do that. But I don't think if we focus only on Ebola, we're going to solve quickly the problem, because this population are missing everything. And what they don't like is team arriving in the village, taking the dead body, asking questions, taking the sick person and running away with it, when the local health center don't even have a pill of paracetamol to distribute, or anti-malaria or nothing. I think we have to put in every health center in all the structure, give them some supply to show the population that, yes, we are interested in the health, not only in Ebola, but in health in general. And if we do that, I think that will open a lot of doors that remain closed because people are scared of Ebola.
What else would you like to discuss?
On
anything.
On anything? I think the impact of all the, I would call it, maybe it's not correct, but media frenzy around, and scientific frenzy around this Ebola, and it seems to be maybe more in developed country than in the country involved, and all of that run to a system that the airline are afraid to fly, and then the embassy are getting the non-essential person out, and the airline are even more afraid to go, and then very soon we will have no airline to go in the country to help or bringing supply or doing anything, and the country will be hurt economically, and that's a big problem. The other thing is, if Ebola arrive in the U.S. or in Western Europe, I don't think there will be an outbreak. There could be maybe one or two secondary cases, but people with the system put in place in the hospital, people washing their hands, people using disposable equipment, not reusing equipment, wearing gloves, wearing goggles sometime, wearing gown, the risk of transmission is completely different from what we see in the endemic area. So, and every time we had a case of Marburg virus arriving in the U.S. in 2008 that was discovered retrospectively, and nothing happened. If we look at Lassa fever, where we have much more experience, there is maybe 40 or 50 cases that have been exported from this endemic area in Nigeria also to mostly Europe. There never been any secondary case. Could that happen? Yes. Could have one case by a needle stick or something. But in general, because of the hospital infection control, because of the training of the people, large outbreak will never happen, in my view.
Great. Well, thank you very much for what you continue to do and have done. It's, you know, one of the great things about my job is that I get to meet people like you, who not only are the world's experts in your area, but are so focused on helping people avoid terrible problems or reverse them. And I really wish you could have heard how the U.S. ambassador spoke about you, kind of the model of what we think we do whenever we're at our best, which is we get the technical details right, we get the interpersonal details right, we get the communications right, and we do that with not only when we're out of this country, not only with the media, but with the healthcare workers there, the political leaders there, the U.S. expatriate community there, and the communities there. So I think clearly your quiet competence and your effective work there is a big part of why Guinea is so far ahead and so close to being able to control this as long as the other two countries do it.
He's a great ambassador, too.
Great to meet you. Great to see
you. Thank you.